Okay, good morning, everyone. We're about to begin. We're holding on in the middle of the sixth parak. Tanya, Daf, this would be in the little red Tanya that we're using over here. It would be on page 20 on the top. It's confusing. There's 24 on the bottom and 20 on the top. And that's what we're holding. Okay, so in the previous classes, we were learning about the concept that we all possess two souls, a godly soul, which is a piece of Hashem from above, which strives continuously and perpetually towards Hashem, towards a relationship with Hashem. That's what its entire being is all about. And then we have an animal soul, which is an animal in the sense that it's only knows of itself and seeks its own pleasure, fulfillment, gratification. And that's what it is all about. And he explains over here, see in the earlier chapters, he dissected the godly soul, its root, the components of what make up what it is, and also its manner of expression. The garments of the soul, which is the behavioral element of the neshama, which is the behavior of Torah and mitzvahs, which is through Torah and mitzvahs that the neshama achieves the ultimate bond and connection to Hashem. Now, on the other side, in this chapter, in the next three chapters, is where he's going to talk about the animal element in the human being and completely break it down to all of its components. So the root of the animal soul, he said, is a soul. It's an entity that's a spirit of unholiness because it comes from the unholy side. It comes from the klipa. It comes from the realms that of darkness that conceal and cover on Hashem. That's why in itself, an animal soul doesn't know Hashem. It's full of its own being, its own self, to the point where it can get corrupted, where it completely rebels against Hashem. Even if it knows something is wrong and against Hashem's will, it can still do that, because it is an entity of darkness. That's number one. Then he says that just like the Hashem created the world, that the good and the bad are balance each other out. So zelu umazeh. So just like the neshama has 10 powers, which make up the personality of the soul. The 10 powers of the neshama are 3 intellectual powers and 7 emotional powers, which make up the esses spheres, the 10 attributes of the soul. And so too, the animal soul also has 10 attributes, which is a power of cognition, a power of intelligence, in which it knows and it recognizes and it can understand the world. And then it has 7 emotional attributes. Now, in contrast to the godly soul and the neshama, the power, the main strength of the neshama is in its meichen, in its intelligence. The emotions follow the intelligence. They're born out of the intelligence. The animal soul, on the other hand, its main power and its main strength, it's not so much an intellectual being, it's mainly an impulsive being. It's mainly an emotional entity. It has intellect that gives some guidance. Just like we see, as we learned last week, little children have an appetite and an attraction to silly things. As they grow older, their emotions sort of grow with them to desire and want and crave for things of greater value, not necessarily of true greater value, but at least of some degree of more sophisticated cravings. So instead of desiring a little matchbox cars, little toys, they're going to want real Mercedes or something like that, a big car. But the idea is that there is a change in the emotions of the person based on the intelligence. So we see that even in the animal realm of the human being, the intelligence has somewhat to say on the emotions. However, the intellect is not as pivotal, not as important by the animal soul as it is in the godly soul. Because in the animal soul, our emotions are provoked just like that. You don't need so much meditation to meditate on a piece of chocolate cake for a long time until you get an excitement to it. In contrast to that, in order to feel something towards Hashem, to feel a desire, a yearning, a thirst towards godliness, takes a lot of learning, takes a lot of meditation, a lot of thinking, because the divine soul, the godly soul, its moichen, its intellect has a lot of power over the lave, over the heart, meaning it needs a lot of exercising of the strength of the mind in order to provoke the emotions of the heart. And again, of course, everything is relative. There are people that are very, very emotional people, and even in their spiritual selves, their emotions, you know, they hear a song and right away their emotions are kicking. and they're excited, and they're just by davening, opening a siddur, and that's a blessing. But for most people, it's not so easy. It takes a lot of thinking in order to get a true, substantial, real, genuine emotion, not just a fantasy, but something real and feeling. So that was what we learned last week. The composite of the animal soul, the godly, is that it's also 3 intellectual powers, 7 emotional powers. Then he says, just like the neshama expresses itself in 3 garments, which are thought, speech, and action of Kedusha, which would mean those mitzvahs that we do in thinking, which would be more like Torah study, where we think holy thoughts, or and in davening, also involving the thought. And then there is speech, which are the mitzvahs that we do in speech, like making blessings and the like, and studying Torah with your mouth by verbalizing and articulating the words. And then action, which is the realm of mitzvahs. Pesach is coming, we can eat matzah, we can eat the maror, we're going to do all the other mitzvahs that revolve the Pesach, or putting on tefillin every day. And these are things that we're doing in terms of action. So just like there is thought, speech, and action on the side of holiness, there's the thought, speech, and action on the side of the unholy, which means that whenever a person allows their emotions of their animal soul, their unholy emotions, which are cravings and desires towards that which isn't godly, that which isn't right, we're going to see soon that that includes even ordinary things that we don't necessarily look at as bad. They're not in any way. It can be cravings and desires, even to kosher stuff, but we're going to leave that for soon. If a person allows those feelings and emotions to materialize into their behavior, which means to think it, to think it, to speak it, or to do it, now their power of the neshama has actualized itself in a garment. It expressed itself in a specific shape and form, in a specific entity, as opposed to before the person experienced it, was thought about it, or spoke it, or did it. It doesn't mean that the emotion wasn't there. The emotion was there. The emotion is always with you. In other words, a person has certain cravings, certain desires, whether they're conscious of it, whether they're thinking about it, or they're not thinking about it, it's still part of your hard drive. It's just not coming onto the screen. So when you're giving it, when you're bringing it into the conscious self, either on the level of thought, speech, and action, that's called putting it into a garment, into an expressed outer state. And then they're called the 3 impure garments, which are hosting the ten impure powers of the soul, because we're dealing with an impure soul, with an unholy soul. That's what we learned last week. Now he's going to describe a little more, what does it mean? What kinds of thought, speech, and action are we talking about over here that we're saying that this is the impure element in the human being? Are we talking about something that is very vulgar, very, very ugly, and very lowly, and very sinful? And he says not exactly so. He says anything that we do that doesn't have explicit godly content is already considered the unholy, even if it's kosher. And that means that there is really no parev, really, in Judaism. There's either holy or unholy. There are certain things that are sinful, as we're going to see later. Sinful things are things that we can't make holy. Even if we have all the right intentions, they remain unholy. We can't make them holy. And then there are things that are permitted. The permitted means it's also unholy, but the beauty is that we're able to make it holy, and that's our job, by giving it some spiritual content, some godly content. But in and of itself, if we just leave it in a natural state, it is still considered impure, unholy, and coming from the animal consciousness that is disconnected from Hashem. And it causes a person to become more and more disconnected the more a person indulges in it. That's why, according to Chassidus, it is so important to serve Hashem in all your deeds, in everything, that a person never loses focus. Because all the things that we do, Kol Ma'aseicha Yehi L'Hashem Shamayim, always has to have a godly purpose, because that's the way we bring Hashem into it. A relative devoid from godliness. It's just, as he's going to explain over here. We're holding on page 20 again. Is the 4th line from the top. He says, Vehein Heim. The line begins with the word B'Sha'as Ma'isa, at the time of action. We're holding by the words Vehein Heim, and they are Kol Ha'Maisim. These are all the actions. Ashanasim tachas Hashemesh. Such a powerful statement. It says, all the activities that are done beneath the sun. Everything that's happening under the sun. If you're walking down the street and you're walking past Starbucks, people are sitting now Sunday morning and they're sipping coffee, they're reading their newspaper, they're on their computers. People are just doing stuff. There's activity happening on the street. People are going shopping. They're in the mall. They're going to the beach. They're going to the drains. They're coming. All that activity, he says, and all the thoughts that are going on in people's minds and in the world, this is all considered the impure, unholy thought, speech, and action. He says, all the things, asher nasem tachas hashamish, that are done under beneath the sun, asher hakol, that all of the above mentioned, hevel, they're all vanity, v'ru'us ruach, and the striving of the spirit. All right, so this is all considered unholy. Everything out of it. And striving after the wind, as he calls it. V'ru'us ruach, and striving after the wind. K'mo shekasa b'zohar, as it is stated in the Zohar, b'shalach, and in b'shalach, shehen tevura, teviru deruchan. Basically, this idea that everything that is done tachas hashemesh is considered vanity, and ru'us ruach, this is basically a statement coming from what's it called again? From Kehelis. Shlomo HaMelech says, "Kol ha'masim asher tachas nasim tachas hashemesh hakol hevel v'ru'us ruach." All these things are hevel, foolishness and emptiness, vanity, or ru'us ruach, and a broken spirit. So, what does that mean? So, the regular mafarshim say, the Metzudas of it says, this is referring about a person's obsession to acquire and the acquisition of materialistic things. Person is involved and you're seeking to increase your wealth. In the end, it brings you, what does it mean, ru'us ruach? It's silliness, and it will only bring heartbreak. That's all it does. Because these things, in the end, cause it causes you more trouble than nachas. That's the simple meaning. So over there, it's specifically limited to a person's involvement in accumulating wealth. However, in the broader sense, he's bringing from the Zohar interprets this pasuk to acquire everything. Every action, deed, thought that is happening in this world, anything happening under the sun, say, except if it's a mitzvah, or if we're doing it with holy intentions. But anything else that's taking place in this world, it's all considered hevel, Shlomo HaMelech says, or ru'us ruach, and the Zohar says ru'us ruach means it breaks the spirit. What does it mean, it breaks the spirit? The spirit is a spirit of holiness. And these things cause a breakage in the holiness, which means it causes an interference and a disconnect in a person's relationship to Hashem. Because every time a person is engaging in a kind of mundane activity without any spiritual content to it, it's causing an interruption in his connection to Hashem. Doesn't mean that it will stay that way. A person can reconnect. But there is a disconnect at that moment. It's breaking the connection. Because, as he says, tevura teviru derucha, it's the broken spirit. V'chein, and as he explains, and we'll see why in a minute. V'chein, and so too, kol hadiburim, all speech, v'chol hamachshavos, and all thought, ashalo lashem hema, that are not for Hashem's desire. Shalo lashem hema, if they're not explicitly with Hashem, taking Hashem into consideration, if they're not for Hashem. See, the Zohar says only about kol hamaisim, or the activity, action. He is adding over here in Tanya, not only activity, but also thought and speech. All thoughts and all speech are also, if they're not la Hashem, if they're not directed towards Hashem, or uliritzono, which means if it's not a thought about Hashem himself, or liritzono, about Hashem's will, in other words, relating to a mitzvah, which is Hashem's will, or la avodaso, to Hashem's service, to serving Hashem, if it's not connected to either serving God, to fulfilling His will, or if it's not a thought about Hashem Himself, then already this is considered these elements that are coming from the broken spirit, or they break the spirit of holiness. Shazehu. Now, why is that? Now, why would that be that way? Why are we saying over here such an extreme statement that everything that doesn't have any specific godly content is already considered unholy, impure, coming from the realms of the Sitrach? She says, because that is the secret of why the mystics, when they speak about the unholy, they give it various different names. One of them, so generally the world knows that the unholy is called Tumma. Tumma means impurity and so forth. Okay, that is giving some positive description to the unholy. I mean positive, I don't mean a good thing. I mean some a description that is defining what it is. It's impure, it's something like that. The Zohar, however, has another term for the unholy, and it calls it Sitra Achra, the other side. Why does it use the term the other side? Because by telling you that it's the other side, it's really describing that the unholy doesn't have to have any element of evil to it that makes it unholy. The very thing that it's unholy, if it's not holiness, it's already unholy. That's what unholy is. Sitra Achra, the other side. As soon as it's not Kedusha, it already belongs to the realm of the Klipa, the realm of that which is negative and unholy in this world. And that's what he's saying. Shezeo Pidish Lashon Sitra Achra, the other side. See, all the other names we give for the realm of, like, calling it evil, calling it Klipa, shell, calling it, all the other names have some kind of a description that describes that it requires something in order for it to be unholy. But by calling it unholy, or Sitra Achra, we're saying that's it. As soon as it's not Kedusha, it's already the other side. Piddish. And this is unique, what we get from the perspective of the more mystical perspective in Yiddishkeit. Because if someone is just approaching Yiddishkeit just on halachic terms, then our lives are divided in three categories. There is Kedusha, and then there is sinful, that which is tuma and unholy, and then there is a big amount of space in the middle that sort of is you know, free, and a person can have a nice time, a person can have an enjoyable time, do whatever they'd like, and there is nothing bad, there is nothing wrong about that, you know. You can party and just live it up. And of course, there is a siman in Shulchan Aruch, which has kol masecha yilishem shemayim, but that's like for tzaddikim. That's for special people, and so forth. But ordinary people can, you know, you live a life. Now, we also know what the Ramban writes. The Ramban writes that the mitzvah of kadoshim tiyu, to be holy, means that a person should not be excessively indulgent in accumulating materialistic things and so forth. He says, well, that, and he says, if you do that, that's a violation of the mitzvah of being holy. However, one can interpret that and say that means really, you know, if you really become super indulgent, very, very excessively involved, then you're dimming all, you know, you become a real animal kind of a thing. But a little bit, or just enjoying yourself, living a normal life, like, is okay. However, on the more, from the more mystical perspective, we realize it's not that way. That there is two, it's either holy or there is the unholy. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't live life. Quite on the contrary, the Hasidic masters demanded that we don't break the body. We don't destroy the physical world. Quite on the contrary, our job is to rectify it and to use it. However, everything that we do is supposed to be done with a certain consciousness and awareness that this is within the context of a relationship of serving Hashem. So that's the idea that he's saying over here. That Pidish Lashon Sitra Achra, what does it mean? This is the meaning of the word Sitra Achra, another side. Pidish, the meaning is Tzad Achar, another side, She'einai Tzad HaKadusha, if it's not the side of holiness. Okay. But if Sitra Achar is anything that's not holy, that means that we can't define what it is unless we first define what is holy. We have to first give the definition of what is Kedusha, and then we know that everything that is outside of the boundaries of Kedusha is already unholy. So here he's going to give a very powerful description of what constitutes Kedusha. What is holiness? What is holiness? We think, you know, holy, what does it mean? It says, holiness is a simple thing. Holiness is, Hashem is holy. Anything that is connected to Hashem, that's Kedusha. And what does it mean, connected to Hashem? Everything is connected to Hashem. Nothing can exist if it's not connected to Hashem. That flower plant is connected to Hashem. Without it doesn't exist. The table is connected to Hashem. Everything, even the most evil and corrupted thing in the world is connected to Hashem, or else it wouldn't be in existence. So when we say connected to Hashem, doesn't mean just that Hashem is giving it life. It means that Hashem is visibly, noticeably present in that thing. That's what it means, connected. Connected to Hashem in a manifest, revealed way. That's holiness. Anything where Hashem dwells in that element, that where there's a noticeable presence of Hashem. That's the idea. As he says, V'tzad HaKadusha, and the realm of holiness, Einoi, isn't anything else, Ela Hashra V'Hamshacha, Miktushasei Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a dwelling, and a presence of the holiness of Hashem. Good. Now the question is, so good, so where does Hashem dwell? If Hashem dwells in a place, in an open, revealed way, it's Kedusha. So what are the qualifications now we need for Hashem to dwell somewhere in an open, manifest way? So now he adds another thing. Ve'ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shoira, and Hashem doesn't dwell, Ella al davar shebatal etzlo yizbarach. Hashem can only dwell on something that surrenders itself to him. Something that is in a state of abnegation to Hashem and surrender to Hashem, that's where Hashem can dwell. Like the famous, beautiful story of the Kotzker Rebbe, that one time he locked himself up for many years in a room, and no one can come see him. And the Chassidim, one time he came out, and it was like, wow, the Kotzker Rebbe suddenly emerged, and when he came out, it was like, and he came out and he said, and he asked a question. He said, where is Hashem? Where is God? So the Chassidim started giving all kinds of answers of where Hashem is. They were saying, Hashem is, he's everywhere. Hashem is everywhere. So he says, no, where you let him in. That Hashem only is where we let him in. And where do we let him in? In order to let him in, we have to make space for someone. If you invite someone in your house and your room is full of boxes, then the person doesn't have any space to be there. For Hashem to be in a certain place, he has to have space. The idea of space means, when the person is full of himself or full of his own existence and beingness, then there's no room for Hashem to be. That's why the Gemara says that Hashem cannot live in a haughty person. Kol mi sheyesh bei gasas haruach, anybody that has a gasas haruach, which is simply it means haughtiness, Hashem cannot live with a bal gaiva. Hashem says, I and him can't live. The famous story, I forgot already of which tzaddik, of which rebbe that it was, that he came to a town and there were two people, I think it was the holy originer that he came to a city. And he was invited by two people invited him. I mean, everybody wanted, but there were two, people that it was being appropriate for him to stay in their homes because of it was a big enough, a large enough home where people can come and so forth. Especially the Rujna lived a very royal kind of a life. So one person was known to be a big Talmud Chacham and a very big Lamdin and a very, very, a pious Jew and so forth. And the other one didn't have such a good reputation. And the Ruzhiner chose to live by the fellow who there were certain things on him that were a little questionable. And later, so the other guy came and he said a complaint. I don't understand. He says, this and that. And how come you came to live by me and didn't live, you lived by him and you didn't come to me? So he answered, he said, like this. He said, there's a pasuk that says, Ashoichein itam betoch temosam, that God lives with the Jewish people in their impurity. In their tumah, Hashem, nevertheless, He loves us so much, He can dwell with us even in our impurity. But the Chazal also say that where there's haughtiness, Hashem says, I cannot live. With a haughty person, I can't live. So He says, you are a big tzaddik, but you know that you're a tzaddik. You know you recognize how much you know how to learn and so forth. So Hashem doesn't feel comfortable in your home. I don't either feel comfortable in your home. The other guy made mistakes in his life, but he's very heartbroken about the mistakes that he's made. And Hashem can dwell amongst them, so I also feel comfortable to go where Hashem is. So the idea is the secret for a place for Hashem to dwell in is in a place where there is humility. Now, gasas haruach, however, let's understand something. Gasas haruach doesn't necessarily mean a person who's walking around with great pride and pompous and so forth. The idea of gasas haruach, the sages have the words are so accurate. Gasas haruach means really thick-spirited. The ruach means the spirit is thick, which means the very notion that a person is an I, he's a somebody, I'm very into myself, that's a blockage for Hashem. Because here's the emes, here's the idea. The thing about Hashem is that He is hu levadehu ve'ein zulasei. He is the only reality. He is existence. He created a world. Hashem created a world. Yes, He created a world. But the existence of the world is only Hashem. Because Hashem imbues it with existence, vitality every second. So He is the existence of all of creation. Now, in order for Hashem to be visible somewhere, for Hashem to be revealed somewhere, this entity and being has to acknowledge the basic fact that Hashem is and there's nothing but Him. If the thing wants to have God in him, but at the same time wants to cry out, I am, the very statement of I am, claiming that there's something other than Hashem, that's a contradiction to the reality of Hashem, that He is the only one. So when an entity exists and recognizes that its existence is here just as a to serve. It's here as a consequence of Hashem's desire, and therefore its entire beingness is here just to serve something which Hashem, a divine interest. Then it's not a contradiction to the unity of God. Quite on the contrary, it's expressing the unity of Hashem. Who am I? I'm an Eved Hashem. I'm a servant of here. What are my hands and feet? What are my mind? What am I all about? I'm here to fulfill a godly desire. Hashem wanted to dwell in this world, and I'm a conduit to Hashem's light, to Hashem's thing. Then God can manifest himself in this entity. If the thing claims to be a being, a something, that itself is the very notion the thing says, I am, is blocking Hashem's anoichi. Anoichi Hashem alekecha is being contradicted by the person's I. So that's what he says. In order for Hashem to reveal himself in something, Hashem can only reveal himself in a thing that is nullified and buttled to Hashem. Let's give an example, he says. He's going to give an example in a moment. He says, what is a thing that's nullified to Hashem? Where do you have a creation that is created on that one hand, but on the other hand, it's surrendered to Hashem? So he says, in the spiritual world, we are full of such created beings. Malachim. Malachim are entities, they're beings. They have feelings, they have a great intellect, but they're holy beings. Hashem resides in them. Why? Because they are their entire existence, and they know it is to serve Hashem. That's it. That's what they're all about. They're constantly either doing one or two things. Either they're on a divine mission. They're running an errand, so to speak, for Hashem, doing something that Hashem is sending them. That's either. Or they're singing to him. They're praising him. That's what malachim do. They never sit down and just kick back and catch up on the news. Because that would be, an expression of something that they're interested in. They don't have any own personal interest. Because they're so imbued with the aspect, with the recognition that God is the reality of everything. And without Hashem, they don't have an existence even for one moment. That's why every single moment is in a perpetual state of servitude to Hashem. That's why they are holy beings. So when you see a malach, the malach doesn't draw attention to himself. He's drawing attention to his master. If you would encounter an angel, you would leave very strongly aware that there is a great God in this world and he has a great master that he is serving. Either when you see him burning up with desire to cleave and melt in Hashem's light, or when you see him rushing with incredible speed to fulfill Hashem's mission, you say, wow. You leave with a powerful sense of awareness of Hashem. So that is why the angel is a holy entity. In this world, what is holy in this world? All objects that remind you of Hashem. So when you see a Sefer Torah, it's holy. Why do we kiss the Sefer Torah? When we kiss the Sefer Torah, we're kissing Hashem. Because the Sefer Torah is a manifestation of God in this world, because the Sefer Torah, this is Hashem's will in this world. Any book, any holy book, a mezuzah, tefillin, these are all godly objects because they're here to serve the divine. Now, the same is also human activity can also be holy. When a person is doing an act, which is a mitzvah, constituting the Hashem's will, Hashem is now revealed in that place because this act is surrendered to Hashem. And so is all holy activity, everything we're doing, which is a mitzvah. However, he says, all the other things that are happening in the world, and they can be as innocent as, eating cereal for breakfast. There's nothing bad in it. But the fact that when we're looking in that moment, when that is taking place, is there any visible presence or any visibility of God over there? No. There is a bowl of Rice Krispies and a person eating it. Now, the person doesn't have to be eating it, with major taiva, just person is now not recognizing Hashem. He feels his own being. He wants to be. He's eating. That's it. There's nothing godly there in a visible state. That is why it's considered part of the Sitra Achra realm of the unholy realm. That's what he explains over here. Let's read it inside. Ve'ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shora, and Hashem doesn't dwell, Ella only, al davar shebatel etzla yizbarach, on something that is. Something that is bottled to him, bein bepoel mamish, whether bepoel, which means in literal sense, something that is bottled to Hashem in actuality, kimalachim al yonim, like the supernal angels above. The supernal angels above are bottled to Hashem, and that's why they are holy, because there is a divine presence in them. He says, but there is another kind of holiness, bein b'koach, so or in potential. B'chol ish Yisrael, like k'chol ish Yisrael, like every Jewish man or woman, lamata, down here below, shebekocho, that there is in their potential, li is batal mamish l'gaba HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be literally nullified to Hashem, b'mesiras nafsho al kedushas Hashem, in the sanctification and giving their life up for the holiness of God's name. He's saying something else over here. He's saying, what else is holy? Up there, malachim are holy. Now the Jewish people are a holy people. Why are the Jewish people a holy people? What makes us a holy people? So here's something very amazing. What makes the Jewish people a holy nation is not our supreme intelligence. The Jews are smart and they're this. That's all nice. That's not the secret of what makes Jews a holy people. Why are Jews, and all Jews are holy. There's no exception. Every single Jew has a holiness. What does it mean there's a holiness to a Jew? There is a certain dwelling of Hashem inside a Jewish person to a much greater degree than there is in a non-Jew. Why is there a holiness in a Jew? And he says, every Jew, even a Jew who isn't observant, even a Jew who isn't doing a mitzvah, just the very fact, a Jew, why? Because there's a holy soul. But what is the holiness of the soul? Why is the soul holy? Going back to the same thing we said before, anything that is surrendered to God is holy. Anything that isn't surrendered to God isn't holy. Now, you can have a Jew who's living a life where he isn't surrendered to Hashem at all. He's living his entire life similarly, equally to a Gentile. And everything he does is just self-centered. It's all to perpetuate his own existence, to further his own existence and his own beingness. So what constitutes the holiness of this Jew? He says, because inside every Jew there is a potential that is waiting to be revealed, and that is the potential to completely dissolve into the reality of Hashem. In what sense? He says every single Jew has it within him to give his life up, al kiddush Hashem, if kachas v'shalom, push comes to shove. If the person would be, if a person would be faced with a test where someone wants to rip the Jew away from God in a manner of amunah, where someone wants to say you can't be a Jew, or if someone wants to say to a yid, and he says, you know, you can't continue being Jewish. You have to, like, throughout the ages, when people wanted to force Christianity or Islam on Jewish people, yidden gave their lives up, al kiddush Hashem, on the sanctification. And the beauty, what we saw was an amazing thing. Martyrdom was all across the board. It was scholars, and it was simple people. Religious people, not so religious. Even people that lived lives very, very alienated from Jewish observance. Nevertheless, when it came to the question, are you Jewish? These very Jews gave their lives up and were willing to die, al-Kiddush Hashem. And what makes the martyrdom of the Jewish people different than martyrdom that we find in other religions is we see, even today, I mean, a very misconstrued and crooked kind of martyrdom by the Muslims and so forth. But those people that do give their lives, for whatever, first of all, the whole idea of giving their life is not considered real giving life. Because it's just real martyrdom is that what motivates a Jew to give his life, al kiddush Hashem, is not that the person is thinking of the great reward he's going to get in Gan Eden, that he's going to receive whatever it is that they're promised to the Muslims in Gan Eden. That's not what is provoking and prompting the person to give his life. The real Mesiras Nefesh is because the Jewish neshama cannot be disconnected from God. It just can't. And when it feels that it's going to be cut off, see, the reason why a person can sin, what do you mean you can't be disconnected from God? People are always sinning, and we always make mistakes and sometimes put ourselves before Hashem, even at the cost of knowing that there's a disconnect. The thing is because we don't feel the disconnect. In other words, if we were to feel that we are now cutting ourselves off from God, we would never do it. Because in terms of our Jewishness, we cannot disconnect. It's only that you can explain that later in Tanya, that it's possible in our regular lives we don't sense and feel how every sin is cutting us off. We don't feel that. That's why the Jew can, that's part of the Ruach Shtus. The sages say that a person doesn't sin unless a spirit of stupidity, of folly, enters into them, which clouds the mind and clouds their consciousness not to feel that this is a disconnect. But when it's very clear, when it's 100% clear that when you say to a person you have to stop being a Jew, you cannot be a Jew, then the person can. You know, the Christians, when they, a couple of years ago, they were doing this thing. They had this was in, I think, in the 60s. they had this big conference. I think it was somewhere in Asia. They had a conference, and the conference was all about the Jewish problem. And as there, in order for, so to speak, Mashiach to come in their thing, the Jews have to accept. But the problem is that, you know, after hundreds and hundreds of years of putting in so much effort in trying to convert the Jews by force, by this, by that, it hasn't worked. So their thing was, like, what needs to be done? How can we fix this? And they came to a conclusion which was very amazing. Sometimes the guy knows something about the Jew that the Jew doesn't know. And that is, the conclusion was that two things. Jews don't like, they're irritated by telling them, you know, they have to become Christian. That is something that they don't like. And the other thing to tell a Jew to stop being a Jew, that he can't be a Jew, that they can't accept. So they figured they have to coin it, they have to find a new way. And that's when they came up with a new thing as Jews for a J. Now, you can be a Jew. Not only can you be a Jew, you're a Jew. You can, this is the way you're living your Judaism. And that is why when they went out in order to catch Jewish souls, what they did was they play on the Jewishness of the Jew, which means they come to campuses and they wear tzitzis and they're wearing shofar and they're playing Hava Nagila and things like that, which was all a trick to trick and to trick the soul, in a sense, where the person is looking for a connection to God, and now he's told that this is the way that is possible. But if you tell a Jew, stop being a Jew. Or, for instance, there are people who are so, couldn't care less about their Judaism. You see that throughout, you know, anything, they'll go Yom Kippur, they're not going to shul, there's no sense in them of Jew. But when you tell them that their children aren't Jewish, because they married a non-Jew or something like that, they explode. They, like, how dare you tell me that I'm not a Jew? Or how dare, which means that every Jew has a place where he cannot separate from his Jewishness. This is who I am. And that is unique to the Jewish people, which means like this. The fact that people, that you would find in other religions where people have given their lives and so forth, it was mainly the scholarly. It was mainly the devout, people who lived their lives, who were in a monastery, and they lived like they were saints, or people that live in a madrasa, and they're grown up, and they're, boom, this is what they're, so those people will give their lives. But the non-religious, or those who aren't, they don't care about it. But by Jews, there is something intrinsic in the Jew, that even the most alienated from his Judaism, there is a certain point that you can't mess with, where his Judaism is. In the Tanya over here, he explains, that is the attachment of the soul to Hashem, where it's inseparable. And even at the cost of losing everything, even at the cost of losing their existence, meaning I'm willing to lose my existence for God, to completely give up. Why? Because here's the idea. In the core of the neshama, in the nucleus of the soul, at the core essence of the soul senses God more than it senses itself. Which means Hashem is truer, more real than its own existence. And that is what makes the Jew holy, and what makes the Jew different than every other creation. Every other creation in this world, everything, was created in a way where God hides from the creation. So since Hashem hides from the creation, at the core of every being is a powerful sense of I am. And therefore, everything in their life evolves around that I am. I am, and I'm here to advance my existence. I might give for you, I might share, I might do, but I'm thinking always there's something for me. Because the core of its existence is its yeshus, its beingness. There's nothing wrong with that. That's the way God created it. That the core, root, inner, behind all layers and layers, what are you going to find? You're going to find a sense of I, a sense of beingness. By a Jew, if you peel away, the Jew also has ego, a lot of ego. But when you peel away ego, layer after layer after layer, if you get to the core root inner element, what's there is a piece of God, not a piece of self, a piece of God. And you can't mess with that. That thing you cannot ever extinguish, that can never be destroyed. It's always there. And however, a person can live their entire life not connecting to that. That can be dormant, covered up with a lot of schmutz, with a lot of garbage. Person is alienated from it. But when, it's as he says, when the person is faced with the test, if either not being Jewish anymore, that's when you're poking that place, then he's willing to give his life up in order to retain his Judaism, in order to be connected to Hashem. What does that show? That the core root of the Jew, he's batel to Hashem. He recognizes God's truth over his own existence. That is why the Jew is holy. That's the secret to the Jewish holiness. Hashem dwells in every Jew because in his inner space, there is space for Hashem. There is a place, there is a little hole where Hashem can dwell. And that's by every Jew. Question is now, how much is that dwelling that Hashem dwells in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the Holy of Holies, in the Aron HaKodesh of the Jew, is it only in that potential? Is it only in that space? Or does it spread out into their life? So the more the Jew is observant, the more the Jew is involved in Torah and mitzvahs, the more Yid surrenders his life to Hashem, the greater the presence of Hashem, meaning the more it's manifesting and expressing itself in the outer human being. It's not remaining secluded in the inner chamber of the heart. It's manifesting itself also into the outer, external human being. If the person is not compliant with Hashem's will, that means he's still holy, but that holiness is only in his core, not on his outside. And that's something very, very, very fundamental in understanding the holiness of the Jewish people. The holiness of the Jewish people is connected to our potential that's always there, even when we're not having to do it. It's always ready to come out if it would be tested. Ready to come out. If it would be put to the test, it would emerge. And that's why we're holy. So again, v'tzad, so kimalachim alyonim, like angels, bein b'koach. So that's one kind of holiness. Angels are holy in practice, in actuality. It's not potential. Because angels are nullified to God continuously. Every moment of their existence, they're serving Him. It's not about them, it's about their Creator. However, Jewish people are holy because of their potential to lose themselves for Hashem. As he says, Bein b'koach, whether it's in potential, k'chol ish Yisrael lamata, like every Jew below, not just our soul when it's in heaven. Every Jew down here below, even when the soul is in the body. Shebekocho, it is within his power and potential, li yizbatl mamish l'gab HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be literally nullified to Hashem, b'mesiris nafshay al kedushas Hashem, through his self-sacrifice and his giving himself over completely to the holiness of Hashem. Elchein amar Rizal, and that's why the sages tell us, shafilu echot sheyoshev oisek b'torah shechina shruya. Even one individual human being who studies Torah, the divine presence is dwelling on that person. The question is, sages say in Pirkei Avos, say even one, say really they speak over there, asara sheyoshin, if 10 sit and learn Torah. Then it says even 3, then it says 2, and even one person that sits, the Shekhinah rests. Now you say, in order for the Shekhinah to rest, we would think requires what kind of purification, soul refinement and work. Here we say every single person. It doesn't make a difference which one. If a Yid studies Torah, the Shekhinah is rest. And the idea is like this. How is the person a Keli? So you see, the Torah is holy. The Torah is holy, but the person might not be a holy person. So how is it that the Shekhinah rests? And the answer is, every Jew has an intrinsic holiness because in his inner hearts and hearts, no matter who he is on the outside, he's ready to give his life up, his entire existence up, al-Kiddush Hashem. So there is a seat, there is a place, a vessel. There is already a vessel. Every person has a vessel where Hashem can rest. It's only that when he's not studying Torah, then Hashem is dwelling in his inner heart, but it's not revealed on the outside. When the person is studying Torah, since the Torah is godly and the Torah is holy, so now this Darshra Sashchina is now revealing itself also into a more manifest and an express state outward. And this is if a Yid is studying Torah. How about if you have 10 Jews? So then, because there are 10 Jews together, even if they're not studying Torah, there is a divine presence. In other words, because really each one has already a potential, a bit of Kedusha, a bit of the divine presence on every Jew. But it's not noticeable, because it's only in a, again, it's dwelling in the inner heart, in the Pnimius HaNeshama of the Yid. But when you have 10 people together, it creates enough of a setting for this to be more explicit and revealed on the outside. See, the kol be'asara, and all 10 people, and when there's 10 Jews together, no matter who they are, or even if they're not practicing Jews and so forth, shchinta shar yala olam, Hashem is dwelling on them always, no matter what. Avo. But that is, again, that is, so that's holiness. Holiness is that which is nullified, surrendered to Hashem. Avo, however, kol ma she'enoi batal etzel yizbarach, whatever isn't batal to him, whatever isn't nullified to him, Elohu davar nifrad bifnei atzmo, but rather is a thing that is separated unto itself, is not einoy makabel chayes miktushas shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is not considered holy. And what does it mean it's not holy? It means it's not receiving its vitality from the holiness of God. Now here he's going to emphasize something very important. And I mentioned that also really at the beginning of the class. What he's saying is like this. It doesn't mean that God is not giving life to that. What are we going to say? Holiness is where Hashem is present. And we would say, so what is the unholy? Where Hashem is not present. But what do you mean, Hashem is not present? Everything has to be connected to him in order to exist. So he explains, it's not receiving life from the holiness of God. It's receiving life from the backside of Hashem. And that's not called, meaning Hashem, it's really, as we're going to see soon, it's 3 points. It's 3 things that are really differentiating it. Number one, it's not receiving from Hashem's inner self. It's receiving from Hashem's back. And that's why it's considered, it's almost as if Hashem is not there. That's number one. Secondly, even the godly light that's there is concealed and hidden. And when we're saying something is holy, it means that Hashem has to be revealed in that thing. That's when it's holy. So going back to what we learned earlier, all thought, speech, and action, all activity that is done in this world that is not explicitly holy, which means it's not done with a godly intention, already belongs into the realm of the unholy. I just don't have the time. So ve'ena makabel chayes mekdushas shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not receiving life from the holiness of Hashem, mipchines pnimiyas hakadusha, from the innermost of the holy, umuhusa va'atzmusa, and its very substance and its essence, bechvaydo ba'atzma. Thank you. Bechvaydo ba'atzma, bechvaydo ba'atzma, in its very glory and essence. Ella, but rather, mipchines sacharayim. The life force that's coming to those things that are not nullified to God, those things that are considered the other side, they are coming from the back of Hashem, as opposed to his front. What does it mean from the back or from the front? Hashem is not a body. Now he should have a front and a back. So this would be similar to a human being. When a human being, when the front of the person, the back of the person, that's the physical dimension. But there is also a deeper element represent, meaning the front and the back. The front of the human being means the person's inner vitality, their inner interest. When you love someone very much and you desire and you care about them, so when you're giving them something, you look at their face because you're looking at them. If you're what's it called again, not liking someone, so when you're giving, you're throwing it over your back. That's what the Zohar says. So you say, here, take it. It's mentioned other times, like when you're sending your check to the IRS, you're just gonna drop it in the mailbox. And you don't really wanna. You're not there. You know, I have to do this because I have to do this, but I don't want to do it. When you're giving something for someone you like, then you're doing it with your face, which just means your inner self. So the idea is as follows: when God gives life to the world, He gives life in 2 ways. When He supports those things that are serving Him, surrendered to Him, and fulfilling his interest in creation, he is loving it, desiring it, and therefore he gives it life with a smile from his inner self, which means he's pouring himself into it. When Hashem is giving life to those things that are necessary in creation, but he really hates them and he doesn't desire them, but they need to be here for whatever reason, they need to be in the world until Mashiach comes in order to create a balance, there be a test between good and bad in the world. So there has to be koiches atuma, powers of unholiness and evil in the world. Hashem despises them, but he's giving them life no matter what. That means that he's giving it from his back. Now, it doesn't only mean the manner in which he's giving. According to this, the difference is the manner. He's giving life, but he's giving, here the manner is this is a he's giving it with a smile, and he was giving it sort of like he has to from his back. But in truth, it's really more than that. When you're giving something with love, then you give yourself into it. It's not only the gift you're giving, you're putting yourself into that gift. When you're giving something that you don't want, that you don't like, you're giving, but you're just making a deposit, but you're not there. And that's what we mean, that God gives life to the unholy, but he's not there. And that's why we're saying that Hashem is only present in the realms of holy. He's not present in the realm of holy unholiness, even though he is still their entire existence. He's giving them life, and without them they couldn't exist. But he's not there, which means his kedusha, his inner self, is not present over there. That's number one. The second difference between the life force that is going to the kedusha and the life force that's going to the unholy is that in kedusha, he's giving from his inner self, and also the life, when it's being delivered into the realms of Kedusha, is not concealed and not hidden. It's there in an open way. I mean, there has to be some concealment, because if it would come completely open, then the creations couldn't receive it. So there has to be some dimming of the light and blocking of it, just that it should be able to be handled. But generally, it's an open thing. When he's giving life to the realms of the unholy, it's coming from the back of him, and then it goes through a process of concealing and diminishments. And as he says, it descends through multitudes and multitudes and multitudes of filters and screens, to filter, to screen it, to darken it, veils and curtains, also through powerful contractions, till the life force can be so diluted and so diminished that when it comes into this creation, it can allow for a creation to come into existence that's going to ignore God. Because how is it possible that God, who is the very root of its existence, the very root of its beingness, and without Hashem it doesn't even exist for a moment, how is it possible for the thing to be oblivious of Hashem or to act contrary to God's will, to ignore him and rebel against him? It's really an impossible thing. Hashem has to be so hidden and concealed. So here you have the paradox. On the one hand, he's giving it its life, and without him, he doesn't exist at all. On the other hand, God has to be so anonymous, so hidden, so concealed, that the entity shouldn't know it. For that, it requires that the energy itself goes through a process of dilution and diminution, till it's so disconnected from its source, and that's when it gives life. And that's the idea of the going down through a process of acharam. Like he says over here, he says v'kol ma. Let's read this again. V'kol ma avol kol ma she'enei batel etzlo. Anything that's not nullified to him. Ella hu davar nifrad bifnei atzmo, but it's separated from him. Einei makabel chayes miktushase shel hakadosh baruch hu. Is not receiving its vitality from the holiness of God. What does it mean, holiness? Mipchenes pnimi es hakadusha, from the innermost of the holy. Omohusa v'atzmusa b'chvoyda ba'atzma, and its very substance and essence, which in its elo mipchenes acharayim. Rather, it's receiving from the backside of God. That's number one. It's coming from the back. Secondly, sheyordim imadrega lamadrega. It descends from level to level. Revavis madregis, myriads of levels. B'shtal shel ha'olamos, through the progression of worlds, it descends through a progression of worlds. Derech ila va'al, through a system of cause and effect. V'tzimtzumim rabim, and multitudes of contractions. Atchen esma'et kol kacha oir v'achayos, until it's diminished so much, the life force and the vitality. Miut achar miut. Miut meaning diminishment after diminishment, at she yachalis tzamtzum ulehislabish, till it's able to contract and to contract itself, ulehislabish, and to enclose itself, bibchinas galus taich isay davar, in a manner of exile in that element. Here he brings us to the third difference between the holy and the unholy. In the origins of life, where it's receiving its vitality, in the process and how it's processed, in the holiness, it's not veiled when it comes down to that degree. In the unholy, it's veiled and veiled and veiled. It comes down with in a very, very concealed state. And third difference is that when it finally registers in the creation, when it finally comes down into this creation that is going to be an entity of, so into the recipient, in Kedusha, the life force is open, revealed. It's expressing itself. It's free. In the unholy, it's in a state of exile, which means God is there, or the divine energy is there, but it's imprisoned. That's the idea of galut hashchina, of the galus of the shchina, of the exile of the shchina. What does it mean, the exile of the shchina? Is that, what is an exile? When someone is in exile, he's not free to express himself. And when you're in prison, you can do what you want. You have to do what your captors make you do. When a person is free, then you act and do as you wish and express yourself. When Hashem's life has entered into those forces of unholiness, it can't express itself because it's not doing what it would love to do. Quite on the contrary, it's giving life to things that are antithetical to him, things that he really hates. He's giving life to a being who is using that life, God forbid, to do all kinds of, to wreak havoc on the world and to hurt people and to hurt and push the world in the opposite direction that Hashem doesn't want it to go. Nevertheless, Hashem is giving it life. So that's what it means. The life force is in a state of imprisonment. In galus, in this entity, so v'lislabish b'pchenas galus toich oisadaver, in a manner of exile in that thing, toich oisadaver hanifrad. I'm sorry, in that thing that is separated from Hashem, lahachyoisoi, to give it life, ulakaimoi, and to sustain it, may ayin liyesh, from nothing to something, which means to bring that entity into existence that it should exist, because without the godly input, it would be nothing. Because it doesn't have any existence unless Hashem is giving it life. Shelo yachzar, that the thing should not revert liyos ayin v'yefes kebetchila mikoydim shenivra, that it should not revert to absolute nothingness as it was in the beginning before it was created. Because initially the thing didn't exist, and Hashem gave it its existence. But when the life force that Hashem has implanted into this creation is in a state of exile, in a non-expressed and imprisoned state. Ulachein, and therefore he says, Nikra olam hazeh maloyoi olam aklipos. Now he summarizes and he says, it's for this reason that this world that we live in, the physical dimension of existence that we live in, so in the writings of the Kabbalists and the writings of the Arizal, this world is defined as a world, the world of klipa. This is a world of the shells, of the klipa, of the unholy. The sitra achra on the other side. Why would we call this world? Say, because a lot of bad and evil goes on. A lot of bad and evil. But that's not most of the world. We say most of the world that's happening, most activities. There are criminals. There are wicked people in the world. But that's, you know, it's a certain part of society. But not most. How can we characterize this entire world as a world of klipa and sitrach? But based on the definition that we learned now of what means holy and what means sitrach, holiness is only something that is surrendered and Hashem is openly manifest and revealed in it, we understand that in the higher worlds, in the world of the Malachim, if you enter into that world, or wherever you look, there are signs telling you about God. Because wherever you look, Hashem is recognized, and Hashem is being responded to. In our world, most of the activities that are happening right now in this world is not taking God into consideration. Most of the happenings that are happening in downtown, or anywhere, even if it's not bad. People are just doing business, people are walking and doing leisurely stuff and enjoying themselves. It's not with a godly awareness. That is, and again, it's not the people's fault. It's not that anybody's doing anything deliberately bad. It's the way this world was created in a manner that Hashem is concealed and hidden, and therefore the world experiences itself as a something that exists independent from God, and therefore people are pursuing their own interests. Where is their holiness? Well, there is holiness taking place right now, because it's Sunday morning, and there are shuls where people are davening right now. There are yeshivas where children are saying kametz alafa, and they're learning chumash, and they're learning, and that's holiness. Now, the point that Hashem put us into this world is that we should make this world holy. And how do we do that? Through the mitzvahs that we do in this world, and also to a very big degree, when we live our lives and we add a little bit of godly awareness, even in the mundane things that we're doing, and we do them for a proper purpose, then we remove the shell, we remove the klipa, and we reveal the Hashem that's there. And that's how we make the world holy, as we're going to learn. As he says, so our world is characterized as a olam aklipas, a world of klipa, the sitra achra on the other side. Elechein, and therefore, Kol maisei ha'olam hazeh, all the actions and activities of this world, kashim v'royim, are as it, in Pri Etz Chaim it says, all the things in this world are severe or harsh, v'royim and evil. V'arishoyim goivrim boy, and the wicked prevail, are stronger in this world. The very, very atmosphere of the physical universe is in a state of unholiness, and therefore it lends itself towards unholiness. And we basically have our work cut out for us to change this world. Baruch Hashem, we're living right before the days of Mashiach. We've already done the job. We've already made this world holy. It's not seen yet. It hasn't been seen yet on the most external, outer layer. I mean, when we still look at the world on its most external layer, we still don't see the Kedusha. We still see the unholiness. But today, it's not really too much. Because when he wrote this book 250 years ago, the klipa that was on this world was much thicker. As a result of another 250 years of purification of Torah and mitzvahs, we've already polished. And there's maybe a tiny little thin membrane of unholiness at the surface, which we have to break through, which we are, Be'ez Hashem, going to break through very quickly. And we're going to see the Kedusha that has accumulated within. So again, see, that's also an interesting thing. The fact that we look at the world and see still that it doesn't seem to have become any holier, quite on the contrary, it seems that it's going on, that's not necessarily a true evaluation. Because just like when a person comes to a doctor and the doctor looks at the person and a person thinks that he's very, very sick because there's been a breakout of a rash or something on the outside, and the doctor actually takes a look and the doctor says, well, you're actually doing very well now because all the garbage has now come. I gave you these medicines and these treatments that have now brought all this garbage out to the outside. So it left you. It left your inner self. It's just on the surface. Quite on the contrary, a person can come and feel very good and look like they're in perfect health, but the doctor takes a blood test and takes a look at the inside. So the way we look at things necessarily doesn't mean that that's the way it is. We know that we're standing right before Mashiach. We know we have already rectified the creation and the world is ready to enter into a state of complete Kedusha. But he's saying the world as it is before Jewish people come and change the world and bring Kedusha into the world, it is a world of Klipa, it's a world of Sitra Achra. And that's how it might still appear to us. Okay. Everybody should have a good week. Next week, we won't have a class. Next week, Sundays, right before Pesach. We won't have a class. We'll resume Be'ezrat Hashem. Be in touch if we'll do one on Chalamod. Maybe we'll do one on Pesach, Chalamod, or maybe then after Yantif.